Welcome to Arts Impact Chats, the podcast diving into the personal and professional side of culture. Thanks for listening.
Hello, and welcome to Arts Impact Chats, the new podcast from Arts and Culture Finance, where we talk to inspiring leaders in our network about the personal and professional side of culture. My name is Siva Phillips, and I'm your host. What is Arts and Culture Finance? Well, we're an impact investment fund manager, taking investment from public, private, and philanthropic funders, and then lending those funds to social purpose organizations, which in our case are creative and cultural organizations. Over the last 8 years, Arts and Culture Finance provided over £10 million of impact investment to over 50 organizations across the UK, from theatres to music venues to dance companies and museums. This project has enabled us to work with some truly incredible organizations led by some very interesting people with great stories to tell. And this is exactly what we'd like to showcase through this podcast. Today's guest is Craig Pennington, who is the founder and director of Future Yard, a music venue in the town of Birkenhead, which is sandwiched between the northwest of England and North Wales. Birkenhead is on the Wirral Peninsula, on the left bank of the River Mersey, and directly opposite the city of Liverpool. Liverpool, of course, is a world-famous city, rich in culture, and is home to perhaps the most famous musical group in history. But Birkenhead has got its own story to tell and its own musical legacy to celebrate. In this conversation with Craig, we talk a bit about some of the music and artists to come out of Birkenhead, the role of music and culture in creating places that we're proud of and want to visit, as well as the advantages that small towns and places have in being able to build broad cultural coalitions. We talk a bit about quite a few other things too, but those are the headlines. Craig has been working in the music industry for nearly 2 decades. Prior to Future Yard, he co-founded the Bidolito magazine and creative agency that promotes music and culture in Merseyside. And other projects for Craig have included 6 editions of the Liverpool International Festival of Psychedelia, which was named Best Small Festival at the 2015 NME Awards. So here's our conversation, recorded over Zoom at the start of August 2023. I hope you enjoy listening to Craig as much as I enjoyed speaking with him. Craig, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you for joining. Can I ask, where are you dialing in from?
So yeah, thank you very much for the invitation, Siva. It's really appreciated. I'm dialing in from our recently opened workshop space here at Future Yard. So very on brand, block yellow wall.
It's a nice like mustard yellow in the background there. I quite like it.
Yeah, it is. We deal in strong rattle colours
at Future Yard.
But yeah, so from the venue, on the Birkenhead on the sunny side of the River Mersey.
Great. And can you just sort of tell us a bit about Future Yard in your own words? So maybe a sort of a sales pitch for our listeners to come to the venue.
So Future Yard is a grassroots community music venue in Birkenhead. We are, I suppose, here to bring the most exciting new emerging music to our town. So we program a wide range of emerging electronic music, alternative music, jazz, hip hop, contemporary classical. That's our kind of core being, and I think we're good at that, and have demonstrated over the last couple of years a real kind of strong program, which has brought around 40 to 50,000 people to Birkenhead for live music experiences that wouldn't be coming here otherwise. But really our real true essence for being is how do you reimagine a community music venue as a real kind of driver of meaningful social change in a place? And how do you utilize your model to really kind of bring about that change? We believe, and I believe, that music can change the world. That's the reason why we get out of bed in the morning. That's the reason why I come in to do my job. And with Future Yard, we look to create a community business model that really creates a kind of a best case kind of demonstration of how you can achieve that in a place like Birkenhead. I mean, for those who don't know, an amazing musical heritage from this part of the world. You know, a lot of the artists that people kind of perceive in their kind of collective imagination as being artists from Liverpool are actually from Birkenhead and the Wirral Peninsula. But we have an all-day live music venue, which is dedicated to supporting emerging new talent in this town for 30 years. So, you know, it was a real missed opportunity, and also in a place of a quite acute social challenge. So the ward that we're located in is in the bottom 1%, measured through indices of multiple deprivation. A lot of challenge here. That was pre-COVID, even more acute kind of post-COVID. And what we've tried to do is create a model which is all about creating as rich a positive impact socially as possible by opening out our space and reimagining it as a training resource, as a real kind of like valuable collective community resource, and thinking about how we make sure that our work reaches the people who are in the most need within our local community.
And you've said this before, that music can be utilized as a tool for development and change. And I kind of wanted to make that the theme of this conversation, because I think it's a really powerful and interesting theme that I think will resonate with a lot of listeners. But just provide a bit more context about the artists that you've been referring to. Can you tell us a bit about those artists that have come from Birkenhead?
Yeah, absolutely. So artists who've come from Birkenhead and the Wirral, so this side of the river, mm-hmm. rather than Liverpool. I don't want this to become an anti-Liverpool conversation.
Yeah, of course.
I dearly, dearly love Liverpool, but you know, like any city, it's got its own regions and areas that got their own stories to tell. But artists like The Coral, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Forest Swords, bands like Hooton Tennis Club, Elvis Costello grew up in Birkenhead. The Wirral has always produced slightly offbeat, off-kilter, alternative, slightly odd, weird and interesting and fabulous kind of like music. That's the kind of thing that comes from this part of the world. I think being kind of like almost halfway between Liverpool and North Wales gives it a slightly different kind of perspective. Kind of that geography kind of creates a different artistic outlook. So yeah, there's some of the artists that come from this part of the world.
And what are some of the artists or bands that have played at Future Yard?
I mean, luckily we've had nearly all of those play recently. So not Costello yet, we're working on that one. But we had OMD came and did one of the shows for us very, very early on. The Coral played an exclusive small show for us as part of the Eurovision celebrations when the was hosting Eurovision. But, you know, away from that, I think, you know, some of the most exciting shows that we've had. We've hosted a band called Bodega from New York, who've played a couple of shows for us, actually coming back and headlining our Future Now Festival in August. I think that a very, very exciting, buzzy, Brooklyn-based post-punk band coming and playing regular shows in Birkenhead, that just was beforehand. And if you think about the aspiration and the level that kind of paints for local emerging new artists and local people, I think that's a really, really key example. But, you know, people like folk artists like Sierra Ferrell, we've had, you know, a real mix of hip-hop artists like Marlo. We've hosted a number of shows with Manchester Collective, real kind of mix of genres and, you know, trying to be as diverse as possible within our programming. But yeah, I think that sold out Bodega show was a real highlight for me.
For those listeners unfamiliar with Birkenhead, can you tell us a bit about the town? So maybe about its heritage and cultural and otherwise, and maybe some of the challenges that it's experienced in more recent times?
Yeah, absolutely. So Birkenhead is a former shipbuilding town. The Camel Edge Shipyard is in Birkenhead, and essentially the town grew out of the shipyard and the ancillary kind of supply chain that was based around shipbuilding. And, you know, over the last 40, 50, 60 years, there's suffered a very, very similar post-industrial decline story that a lot of, you know, provincial and northern shipbuilding or, you know, towns that are based on, you know, a primary heavy industry have faced. And, you know, had a real, real tough time with that especially during the 1980s, had a very similar story to Glasgow with the decline of the shipbuilding on the Clyde, real issue with the heroin epidemic at that point, and has suffered very, very acutely. I mean, Liverpool obviously had a very, very hard time during that period as well. And Birkenhead was almost one step removed and had an even arguably more challenging experience because of it being even, you know, provincial again, away from the city centre of Liverpool. But and the kind of cultural story within that has also been, you know, really, really interesting. We've got a great mix of writers, actors, the musicians that I've mentioned, a very, very rich and diverse kind of artistic and creative heritage, but a complete lack of investment really in the, the structures around that and the support services around that. And certainly when you look at the decline of kind of centrally funded community arts, community theatres, community libraries, you know, the investment in kind of arts infrastructure through councils and council offices, which really declined through the 1990s, it's kind of been left for a long, long time. And our, you know, interest and motivation around FutureYard, it was only ever going to be in Birkenhead because, you know, if you were just looking at it from a programming point of view, or putting on the kind of shows that we do, you'd put it in Liverpool city centre. That's the easiest thing to do from an audience point of view. But for us, the primary motivation was, if you think about this as an intervention, which is principally about place and about people and about changing what a place means in the world and utilising music and the power of a venue such as this to do that, then you don't put it in the place where kind of the audience engagement is the easiest. You put it in the place where it needs it the most. It really kind of doubles back on that motivation piece.
Yeah. And how did you become involved with FutureYard in the first place, though? What's been that journey? And maybe if you can talk about your professional journey to that point as well.
Yeah. So I've been involved in music my whole professional life. I had a job at uni, a little placement job working for a record company. After skipping around a couple of kind of real jobs for 6 months after uni, I ended up at Sheffield University Students Union as part of the events team, putting on shows there, which was an amazing experience. And then after that, I set up a small community studio space in Leeds where I was living after uni, doing a lot of the things that we do here at FutureYard, but on a much, much smaller scale. So looking at artist development, hosting shows, putting on bigger gigs in larger spaces to try and kind of, I suppose, fund that. And then I came home back to Liverpool in 2010 and started Beat Olito, which started out as a music magazine, which was all about platforming and celebrating the emerging new music in Liverpool. Through that experience, we ran that magazine for nearly 11 years. I got very involved and interested in music policy and the role that music plays within policy frameworks around employment, around inward investments, around education, around, you know, treating kind of music as an industry that needs to be considered and strategized around as a key industry, as an employer, as a driver of GDP. I was very involved working with friends and colleagues at Liverpool John Moores University in shaping a report in 2017 all around the challenges that the music sector was facing in Liverpool, which then led to there being a Liverpool City Region Music Board established with a policy framework around it. And then eventually led to there being a large £2 million and investment fund to support the music sector within Liverpool City Region, which came through SIF and devolution. Now, I think throughout that experience, throughout that journey, certainly that 10-year period doing Beat Olito and becoming more interested in the policy frameworks around it, I really, really understood the power of music to bring about change and started to understand models around the world, particularly some great examples in Europe. The Netherlands do this, you know, and doing this really, really well.
What are some of those examples?
Places like Groningen, but like Maastricht, who use music industries, structures and clustering, basically use clustering as the kind of approach which is normally applied in, you know, automotive, shipping, petrochemicals, different kind of sectors, and apply that to music and culture. And how do you find the indices between music and tech and design and really kind of, you know, create industries that drive inward investment, that drive jobs, that create opportunities for people. And think about that with a really, really strong policy framework. I'm coming at that from a place point of view. I actually, none of this came about by design, but I did a geography degree at university. I didn't do anything to do with music, and maybe realized over the last few years that my real, real passion is places and people and how you can use the kind of things that we do to really bring about powerful change in a particular place. So that experience of being involved in the evolution of what led to the Liverpool City Region Music Board being established, I still sit on that board. I'm still really passionate about that work. Made me really think about, well, if you were going to do something like that, but you're going to do it in Birkenhead, if you're going to do that in the Wirral, that's where I'm from. I grew up literally down the road. I was born in the hospital in Birkenhead. I've got a season to try me for my sins. This is my town. This is where I'm from. So it was, if you were going to do that in that particular place, how would you do that? What would that look like? How would you design your programs? How do you really engage with local people throughout that process and make sure that that's responding to local need? And that's where Future Art came from. That's where the concept was born.
And so initially it started off as a festival, right, in 2019. But can you just explain how it went from festival and what spurred on that idea to the venue that it is today?
So the festival was basically a big, massive kind of case study. Like, it was a big test. I think what I would say is that before the festival, we did something else as well. We did a project in the festival of 2019. I'm rubbish with dates, so I'll take your word for it. It was 2019. Before that, and the year before that, we did a project called Wirral New Music Collective with a little bit of seed funding through a project called the Beautiful Ideas Company, which has now gone on to be Kindred, that people will be aware of, which is a really, really fantastic organisation that does social investments and social enterprises within Liverpool City Region as well as support. But pre-Kindred, it was a little pilot project. And we basically did a little run of shows, which gave some seed funding out to local people. It was like a few hundred quid to put on a gig in a pub back room or a church hall or in a little industrial unit, basically to try and get some stuff happening in Birkenhead, to seed some shows, kind of put some kind of mentoring support around those gigs and put it together as a program and deliver it. And we did that the year before we did Future Art Festival, just as a way of kind of getting something happening, like getting some green shoots moving, putting some shows on in some nooks and crannies in Birkenhead, just to see if the people were there to support it, if the audiences were there, if there was artists that wanted to come and play in the town. You know, and that went really, really well. It was really, really exciting. And a lot of the people who I came into contact during that process are now still involved, either directly within the team at Future Yard or part of the wider family doing stuff in Birkenhead. Off the back of that, we were really buoyed to, like, let's do a festival. Let's do a festival in Birkenhead over an August Bank Holiday weekend on a wristband model. People can get a wristband, can go and check out shows in a number of different venues, but use some of the key civic spaces because it was all about place. So we managed to convince Wirral Council to partner with us on that. And we used Birkenhead Town Hall as our main stage. It's beautiful old assembly rooms that used to be used for dances in the 1920s, but hasn't been used for live music for a long, long time. We used Birkenhead Priory, which is the oldest building on the banks of the River Mersey, which where the monks originally ran ferries from in like the 1300s. It's beautiful, beautiful space. Mm-hmm. We used those two locations, as well as Bloom Building, which is a community mental health support service that wants to have a great industrial space around the corner. And we just program shows across those spaces with artists like Bill Ryder Jones and Anna Calvi and Black Country New Road, Working Men's Club and Dry Cleaning, artists that have gone on to be really successful. And we did that. 2,000 people turned up and it was incredibly rewarding and exciting and successful. And made us realize that not only was there an audience, there was a group of local people who were passionate about Birkenhead as a town that hadn't necessarily been given the opportunity or a platform to be enthusiastic about it before. So one thing that we did during that festival, all of the crew shirts that all of our team were working, rather than crew being written on the back of the t-shirts, we put the Future is Birkenhead in hot pink letters.
Which has become your slogan, right? It's become the slogan for Future Yard as well.
It's become this kind of defining motif that we still use really, really, vividly today. Mm-hmm. But that just sparked something with people. And it was like, yeah, people get it. People understand. Like, I think football clubs can be great civic institutions when they're run well by people with the right motivations at heart, where they give people a platform about something to be really, really excited about and positive about and proud of. Off the back of Capital Culture in 2008, Liverpool had this kind of cultural and civic pride reawakening. People were proud to be from Liverpool again in 2008. And I think that in our own little way, we're we realized that we could use music in Birkenhead as a way people be like, yeah, I'm from Birkenhead. The future can be Birkenhead. We can be proud of our musical heritage and we can welcome artists from around the country and around the world to our town. It became a really positive vehicle for that. So yeah, and not only that, it also gave us an opportunity to develop really great relationships with our local council, with Arts Council. It gave us that chance to be like, we've got this idea, we believe we can do this. It gave us the opportunity to kind of test out the appetite for that with some key partners. So yeah, it was a big R&D exercise. It was a big test. It was a messy kind of, you know, project kickstart in many ways, but hugely rewarding, I think really, really valuable in our journey.
How did the venue itself, the building come about?
Well, how long have we got? So I'll give you the abridged version of it. We wanted a space, we wanted a venue, because we wanted, rather than, the festival was brilliant, but it was one weekend of the year. And we wanted a space that was 365 days of the year that could drive this change as a permanent fixture. We wanted to buy somewhere because the challenges of live music venues in the context of gentrification and people living in town centres and regen and noise, and we see all the challenges that flare up in every major city in the Western world, to be completely honest. It's no different in New York and Baltimore than it is in kind of like the Northern Quarter in Manchester, or all the issues that are faced in London with venue closures. Gentrification and people living in city centres and real estate values going up doesn't necessarily correlate with a great independent thriving live music scene, because of, you know, people living next to spaces and complaining them getting closed down. So we wanted ideally to own somewhere and not have a landlord that effectively would utilize us to push the value of their assets and then flip us out when it became, you know, expedient for them to do that. But we didn't have any money and we struggled to find a perfect location, because we knew we were going to have issues potentially with neighbors if we were in and around residential. We knew we wanted studio spaces as well as a venue. We knew we ideally wanted a front door that we could open 7 days a week, as well as the live space. So the needs of the physical asset that we needed were quite specific. Then we found this building that we are now in, which
is in the center of Birkenhead, right? So for those unfamiliar with Birkenhead, it's sort of about 5 minutes walk from the train station.
Yeah, it's 5 minutes walk from our main train station. It's over the road from the main bus station. It actually backs onto the Birkenhead Tunnel. So you can drive from our front door to Liverpool City Centre in about 6 minutes, literally just through the tunnel. So from that point of view, from a connections point of view, we needed to be by the train station because we knew that a lot of our audiences would be coming from Liverpool. If you think about it, we're on the river. If you draw, you know, a circle around the venue with us in the middle of it, half of our catchment area is in Liverpool. So we needed to have good transport links. So the venue gave us that. It was a former nightclub. They'd been closed for a few years. It needed a lot of work doing on it to make it habitable, but it gave us a basement. It gave us a first ground floor. It gave us a first floor, gave us the scope to be able to do all the things that we wanted, but it was only up for rent. So initially we took it on a rental. We negotiated a very, very long-term lease that gave us the time within the lease to be able to do the capital work that we needed to do on it so that we could run it as the, you know, the space that we wanted it to be. Now, about 6 months in, the landlords that we were working with on that decided they wanted to sell the building. This is summer 2020. Mm-hmm. So absolutely in the kind of lion's jaws of COVID.
Yeah.
We were faced with a real quite stark dilemma, if I'm completely honest. It was either we found the money to buy it or we ran the risk of, with the landlord that we had at that time, we had a decent relationship with, but with them selling it with us as a sitting tenant, we could have got anyone. And, you know, though we had the protection of long-term lease, anyone who's ever leased a commercial premises will know that if your landlord doesn't want you in there, they can make it very difficult. So yeah, we needed to buy the building. That gave us, COVID was a really, really, obviously inherently an interesting experience, a difficult experience, but in many ways it allowed us to physically get the building how we wanted it to be, and also really, really drill into and define our model and invest in those partnerships and those relationships, which, you know, looking at it now, with the benefit of hindsight, was actually really, really, you know, really, really useful in the development of the organization.
It's a really classic sort of risk opportunity sort of dilemma there, right? Like, yeah. Because presumably, ideally, you would have had a bit more time in the venue to really test it out, to really work out the model. Ideally, this wouldn't have happened during the pandemic either, but you've definitely made it work over the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're right. You're right. And, you know, I've always kind of prefaced any kind of conversation with about COVID and our experience in it with the fact that, you know, for many, many, many millions of people, it was way worse than it was for us. You know, people who lost loved ones and felt the real, real sharp end of that pandemic experience. From our point of view, I can only talk about our point of view, it was very, very challenging. Obviously, financially, we didn't have any audiences in the building, and our model had been based on having audiences in the building within 3 months, because we were going to run a very, very almost spit and sawdust kind of pop up originally and kind of build through the development phases, being able to reinvest the revenue that we would, could accrue during that process. We didn't have that opportunity. So it was very challenging. But you're right, in many ways, it gave us space to be able to get things right and really kind of drill into that model, the vision, the partnerships, how we wanted to operate the space when we did manage to get it open. And I do think that time and that space was really, really valuable. It meant that we opened in this slightly weird, hotchpotchy way because of the fact that of how restrictions were lifted, and you could do things outside and you couldn't do them inside. And then you could do shows, but everyone had to sit down and you had to be a meet away from people. And, like, you know, we did a load of live streaming gigs. I mean, who opens a live music venue and the first 6 months of their program was no one in the room? Like,
yeah,
it was.
It's like a forced experimentation, right?
Forced experimentation is a very positive way of putting it. But no, it was. And it made us dynamic and footloose. And, you know, you've got to respond. You've got to find a way.
You really kind of seized on the opportunity that was presented to you at that time. And it's a risk. And I mean, like any entrepreneur, you have to, you know, weigh it up and take risks.
Yeah, you do. And risks are a good thing. You know, risks are managed and balanced and considered risk is, you're right, that's what, you know, entrepreneurialism or kind of, you know, supporting communities or running any kind of organization is inherently absolutely dialed into risk. It's about being as informed and, you know, across the detail and across the mitigations as you possibly can be.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And there's things that we've tried that haven't worked. But I think the core model and the underlying idea, and I think the fact that it's based on a place and people and a real steadfast and unwavering belief that we can be a positive change for our town means that there's a lot of love and a lot of support and a lot of, I do feel like people have our back, which is really, really pleasing.
And that's a really perfect lead into a conversation around placemaking. So having been to Birkenhead and Fuchsiade a couple of times myself, I think it's a powerful argument for cultural placemaking, by which I mean culture leading the development, revival and regeneration of a place. So Fuchsiade is making the center of Birkenhead a more culturally alive place and a destination for people from outside the area. So this should attract investment into the town and strengthen the community and sense of local pride. But the question is, how do you go about making this truly inclusive for local people? And how do you avoid the perils of gentrification? So I'm sure you're asked this question a lot, but it would be great if you could opine on that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one thing that would terrify me more than anything is an idea that Fuchsiade is some kind of like hipster commune and is kind of disconnected from local people, because that couldn't be further away from the motivation of what it is. And I don't think we are. I don't think people view us like that. But I think that the key rub within what you've outlined there is where that change comes from. Before we opened Fuchsiade, all of my kind of professional and I'm kind of working career in this part of the world, I've been based in Liverpool, and I've been very kind of like, you know, embedded in the Liverpool experience of culture-led regeneration. And the model around culture-led regeneration in Liverpool, which it is rightly celebrated for around the world, is around large civic cultural interventions. It's around like the giants. It's around Eurovision. It's around the Capital Culture Year. Mm-hmm. It's big programs of bombastic artistic moments that are run by a large organization within the city that deliver those. And it's been fantastic and it's great. That's one model of cultural regeneration. Not everywhere in the world has the resources or the opportunity to do what Liverpool has done. And also, I don't necessarily think that that's the right model for everywhere. And I think what we're demonstrating in Birkenhead and on the Wirral is it's culture-led regeneration, but it's from the bottom up rather than the top down. It's about those ideas and those projects and those programs coming from local people, being seeded with local people, being developed with local people, the people who are driving that change, being invested in that place principally and primarily first before anything else. And then that change coming from the bottom up. And I think that's what I'm really interested in. And I'm interested in our model and sharing that model with other places as well, and thinking about, from our experience, that art form has been through music, but I don't necessarily think it always has to be with music as a principal art form. I mean, I'd always argue that music is unique and fabulous and a great way of doing that. But I think music and art and culture are great ways of telling stories.
Yeah.
It's a way of telling a story about a place. And if you can engage local people in those stories and they tell them and then they kind of bring about that change, that's when really kind of meaningful kind of community-led regeneration can kind of take part. The key thing is aligning that with policy frameworks and local authorities and investment that is aligned and kind of on that journey at the same time. And it's one holistic approach. But the two things can't work independently. They've got to be aligned and they've got to be holistic. And I definitely would take this opportunity to say that, you know, our experience with our local council, Wirral Borough Council, is very much in tune on that point. And I think that's when really, really kind of like quite amazing things can happen, when you get that alignment tight.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting point, because I think it's worth talking about your relationship with the local council and how instrumental that's been. But can you give us a few examples? I know that there's actually many within Future Yard of how you engage local people in either programming or in working at the venue itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe if I talk about our soundcheck program first. Before we had audiences in the room, we had local young people essentially learning the skills that they need to go on and have careers in the live music venue. They were doing that in the room before we had audiences. So when we were doing those live stream shows, we had our professional team working those shows, but they were being supported by a group of young people who were doing our soundcheck program to deliver those events. So soundcheck really is about opening the venue up and thinking about every professional role that we have within the organization, that being a learning opportunity for a local young person to develop the skills to then essentially have a career within the live music sector. Jobs and careers within the live music sector traditionally have been reserved for people who've been through HE or kind of degree level study, or have had the opportunity to learn on the job. How do you learn on the job, or even realize there are opportunities that could be had if there's not a live music venue in your town? And then doubly, if that live music venue doesn't create opportunities for you to learn those skills and experiences within their business structures. So, you know, we've now had almost 200 young people through our soundcheck program, and we've got all of our event delivery team within the venue, all of our engineers, all of our event managers, all of our box office staff have all come through that program. Now they're paid members of our team. And we've got a rich group of alumni who are working out at festivals, venues, cultural organizations all around the country. So that model is specifically designed to utilize what we do to create new opportunities for local young people. That's really, really key to us. Another scheme that we run is our neighborhood program. So that's basically a program through which we engage and work really, really closely with other local third sector organizations, housing associations, youth services, women's organizations. And we do a variety of different things where we'll provide free to access tickets for our program. We'll engage those people around the shaping of our training programs. And, you know, those relationships with those organizations are really, really rich as well, because we can create different kind of collaborations with those organizations as well, which we can host at Future Yard. And programmatically, you know, we make sure that we're providing opportunities for people to engage with what we do that isn't just coming to gigs. We run weekly shows on Sunday mornings, which are called Mosh Tots, which are basically gigs for kids. Mm-hmm. So every Sunday morning, we come into the venue and there'll be 50 or 60 kind of 4 or 5 year olds with their parents, you know, moshing along to a band doing a kind of like 7 genre reworking of I Like to Move It. Like, that's what we do on Sunday mornings at Mosh Tots. But that, as much as giving kids their first experience of live music, that's a great way of us getting local families into the venue, having those kind of cultural experiences as a family who, I mean, they would probably not have that opportunity to do that if a venue like Future Art didn't exist in their neighborhood doing that kind of program.
I've not really come across things like that, like Mosh Tots, actually, in other venues. You know, it sounds like a really simple, really effective idea to, you know, plant the seed of interest in music and have something for parents and children to do that's a bit fun and a bit different.
Yeah, I mean, we've just come back, me and my wife and our 2 kids, we were at Deer Shed Festival at the weekend, which is up in North Yorkshire, which we go to every year, which is basically a festival for kids that well-behaved parents are allowed to come to. But then they have like the Comets Come and Play and, you know, Anna Calvi, and like great lineup, but it's for kids. And we were like, why don't venues do that? Because that experience for us as a family is, it's one of the highlights of the year. It brings us closer together. We have a really, really brilliant experience. But, you know, we try and do that every week at Future Art. But it's also like, that's fine for people like me who work in the arts, who've done that for a period of time, who have got, you know, a privilege in terms of like access to those kind of things. But we need to make sure that we're providing those opportunities for everyone. So making sure that we use Mosh Tots as a really key kind of gateway into what we do. We distribute free tickets to that through local primary schools. And we're very targeted with that. They're the primary schools with the highest levels of pupil premium, with areas of the most acute need. And we use those partnerships to reach those families, and we see them coming and we see them coming back. And then those kids will then come and join our New Noise Music Centre. And then they'll do our soundcheck program, and they'll do our Propeller artist development program. And before you realize it, you've got that kind of almost cradle to career pathway, where you're creating young people who are either music fans who feel comfortable engaging within the artistic kind of infrastructure of where they're from, or they're training to be a sound engineer, or they're an artist and on the stage. It doesn't really matter. You can just be an enthusiastic gig goer, or an artist, or an engineer. But we've provided you with that opportunity to do that from when you're, you know, 2 years old to when you're 26, 27.
And you've mentioned your relationship with Royal Council earlier. Can you tell us a bit more about that and the importance of, I guess, the alignment in vision for the role of culture in the local area?
Yeah, I mean, so we've got a really good relationship with our local council. We've had flashpoints, but I think one of the reasons why it works is that they understand what we are. Rather than them thinking that we are just an arts organisation that is constantly asking for things and kind of like is a problem that needs to be resolved, they actually view us as a regeneration organization that's helping them deliver on their vision for the town. So I think that shift of kind of viewing us as a place which is basically we work with them to help solve their problems. What they want are jobs, inward investment, well-being kind of interventions for local people, training for young people. We help solve their problems. So that shift, which I learned quite quickly when we were developing the work around the City Region Music Board and the strategic approach and kind of what that kind of strategy framework looks like for music, it needs to be it's a civic policy that helps to solve the problems of a place. Yeah, we're a music organization and we use music to do that, but it's as much about like what are the challenges that this town is facing. And how do we use our work to solve that? And I think once the council got that that's what we were doing, they're like, right, okay, well, we can work with that because, you know, we've got these challenges that we need to address. It was around the time when Birkenhead was successful in a town deal application to central government for a large regeneration investment. And we worked really closely with the council on the investment proposal and worked collaboratively to make sure that art and culture and music was very much embedded within that offer. And Future Art became part of that proposal around that town deal strategy. So this was a long game. You know, this was a conversation that's been happening for 7-8 years with Wirral Council from we'd like to do this. got this idea for maybe a festival at some point in the next couple of years, building that relationship slowly over a long period of time. So yeah. It's really based now on mutual understanding and trust.
And it's a genuine sort of partnership, maybe of equals. I mean, they're the council, you're not a council, but do you know what I mean? It's it's more, there's an equality to it, right? And I guess mutual respect and understanding, as you say. You've also worked with other local organizations to promote what's going on in Birkenhead under the Left Bank Collective name. Can you tell us a bit about that? It sounds like quite a joined up approach between those organizations as well as the councils. To what extent can that kind of joined up partnership working be replicated in other towns across the UK, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's essential. I mean, Left Bank Collective is a group of organizations that share the same motivations and aspirations for the place, but are working in very different ways. So you've got Future Yard as a you know, community music venue. Got an organization like Open Door Charity, which is basically a peer-led mental health charity that also run a coffee shop and event space. Organization called Make, who support creatives and makers with affordable access to space. There's a great new kind of like business startup incubator called Start Yard. There's a number of different organizations that Convenience Gallery that do brilliant public realm visual art projects. We all work together in a collaborative approach around key moments. So we co-programmed a series of events around the Good Business Festival. We work together very closely around sustainability. We're all actually projects within the Town Deal portfolio, but we're all independent, and we're all independent and community-led and bottom-up. So I think I would definitely encourage that approach in other parts of the country. Some places there'll be an abundance of those organizations that need wrapping together. Some places there might be like one kind of flagpole one, some smaller ones that can be leveling up. That came about quite organically between us as organizations. But again, the council very much recognized that and have tried to support that when they can. Certainly, yeah. I mentioned before around the Good Business Festival, when there was an opportunity to do something in Birkenhead with the Good Business Festival, they were like, right, okay, that Left Bank Collective, let's kind of commission them as a group to do something with that. So yeah, I think it's really important.
Do you think that grassroots organization-led approach is more possible in towns rather than cities? So do you think that this is an area where actually smaller places, like towns, have an advantage over cities and being able to build that broad coalition of like-minded partners?
Yeah, I think in some ways you're right. I think that what it does allow in a town like Birkenhead is that a group of four or five organizations like that can really almost kind of set a tone for a place. Because they're inherently smaller than cities, like a group of organizations really kind of sets a narrative for a place, which cities are much more, you know, bigger, broader, more bulbous entities that like it's harder to do that. That being said, the smaller cities that where that approach I do think can be effective. But I think in a place like Birkenhead, I think it's right for it. I think it's interesting. I mentioned Kindred before. Mm-hmm. Kindred is an organization work supporting STOs, which they call socially trading organizations, which are non-profit, third sector, CICs, organizations like ours. And all of those mentioned before have all been part of Kindred, as well as a number of others. We've been working with them recently on looking at that kind of clustering approach and how narratives and methodologies that are used in commercial sectors and are used in kind of inward investment models and frameworks, how that can be adapted and used within the third sector and within socially trading organizations. Like if you invest in and create a cluster of socially trading organizations, what outputs can you look at cumulatively across those organizations in terms of jobs created, in terms of, you know, impact on GP, in terms of inward investment, the social impacts that you don't get within the other models? And really, isn't that a much more holistic, better way of doing like regen than building a big glass tower and hoping that people come?
And I also wanted to touch on the issue of grassroots music venues, of which Future Yard is one. It's one of hundreds, if not thousands, of such venues up and down the country that I think are essential to a thriving music industry, which I think is one of the few remaining great British exports. So grassroots music venues are key to not only artist development, but the development of all skills related to live performance. But they're very much under threat. We've talked about some of those issues earlier. They're being priced out of the property market. There's wafer thin profit margins. But what do you think are some of the biggest issues facing grassroots music venues? And, you know, if you could campaign for a single policy that would make the biggest difference, what would that be? If you could like wave a magic wand and enact policy change, what would it be?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose just to kind of make a brief comment on the core point that you're making is that, yeah, it's harder to run a grassroots music venue now than it ever has been before. And that is principally a real estate challenge. There's a really, really telling fact that in the UK, 94% of grassroots music venues or music venues full stop are not owned by the occupier. So they've got a landlord. Like 94% of our landlords,
huge, that, yeah.
Which is huge. And if you think that, as you rightly said, that is basically the R&D department of the British music industry, you know, it's a hugely valuable export sector that is worth so much to kind of brand Britain, both from a soft power point of view, but also from a commercial point of view, from an export perspective. To have the whole R&D department for that sector, essentially, at the mercy of private landlords in the context of gentrification, in the context of rising property prices in city centres and town centres is unsustainable and is terrifying. And it's why we were running with, you know, hundreds of those being shut down a year, certainly pre-COVID, post-COVID, that's been obviously a more acute challenge. So I think ownership is the main one. And there's been some really great moves by the Music Venues Trust around establishing new models of ownership. Nesta, you know, using us as a case study. I am going to give you a plug there.
Arts and Culture Finance, please.
Arts and Culture Finance, yeah. Well, we wouldn't have been able to buy our building. You know, it was the only the only offer on the table at that time. Yeah. And we're eternally grateful for that. And we love the working relationship that we have with the team. But yeah, ownership. If the sector owns its assets, it's inherently more sustainable, more permanent. I think I would throw in there, I think that this is more of a kind of a political point, that VAT on tickets is a mental construct that exists nowhere else in Europe. You know, like tickets on cultural events are exempt in the majority of Europe. The fact that 20% of ticket revenue is lost in VAT, when you look at the fact that, you know, no music venues are actually making money on those tickets. That ticket money is just being reinvested in artists and making the shows happen. Yeah. It's one of the reasons why traditionally music venues have operated on a skew model where tickets are capped at price and alcohol is so expensive. And we've created a culture in this country which is completely anchored on alcohol consumption with live music, which I'd love to change.
Yeah.
VAT on tickets is one starting point within that. And my third kind of policy ask is very, very local. Well, I mentioned before that we kind of smack bang in the middle of a city region and half of our audiences are on the other side of the river. We've got not just one train station within a 5-minute walk, we've got three train stations within a 5-minute walk that go out to Chester, out to the rest of the Wirral, over to Liverpool and the bus station. But public transport finishes at 10 to 12.
Right.
So at 10 to midnight, you can't get through that tunnel and you can't get over that river. Point is that from a public transport point of view, at night, there isn't any public transport. And that makes it really, you know, challenging for us with audiences. That affects our programming of what we do and when we finish it. But it also makes it really, really challenging for staff, for artists, certainly thinking about safety, about, you know, people, like especially women that might be trying to travel home at night, certainly by themselves. So reinstating even in public transport, nighttime public transport, night buses is a key, you know, priority for us. It's a piece of work that we've been working with the Liverpool City Region Music Board on. There's a big consultation out at the moment, a survey that's being run to try and look at the appetite for that, which is going really, really well. So I'm confident it's something that our Metro Mayor supports in principle. I'm confident we will see night buses back going through that tunnel in the not too distant future. But yeah, that would be our primary concern locally.
You've got a mini manifesto there with three very specific policy objectives. That's great. Thank you. Just going to take some questions from the audience. So we have one from Louisa, which is, what advice would you give to other venues who are thinking about developing their own sound check program? I suppose the question is, can be put a bit more broadly in that, you know, you've got sound check, you've got Mosh Tots, you've got all of these interventions that try and bring the community along. How can other venues replicate that approach and take a leaf out of your book?
I think one of the first things to bear in mind is that you've got to ask people what they want. You've got to engage with local people and really, really do that in a rich and deep and meaningful way so that anything that you come up with responds to local need. So around 12 months ago, we did a project called What Does Music Mean to You? Where we basically did that. We went out into the local community. We did pop-up gigs in Birkenhead Market. We worked with local partners, have conversations with local people and be like, what role does music play in your life, within your family, and what could we be as an organization to utilize the power of music to bring about positive change in your life? So all of our projects and our schemes and the mechanics that we use to engage local people have come from that experience. So it's come through consultation with local people. So the first thing I'd say is ask people straight off. I think sound check is really quite a simple project. I think that because we designed it in from day one or day minus one, I suppose, before we had our audiences in the room, it becomes more of a culture thing. It becomes more of a culture within the organization that that's what we do. So it's normal for our engineers to have trainees working with them. It's normal for our event managers to have trainees working with them and our box office teams. Like, it's baked into the way we operate. So I think that that's the first thing that I think venues wanting to launch a scheme like that just need to consider, is about creating the kind of the cultural kind of appetite and kind of scope within your organization to make sure that those projects will work. What I would say is that we are currently working away with our partners that we work on Soundcheck with to develop a pilot where we potentially look at working with other venues to replicate that model. So if there is anyone who's either listening to this now or in the future who's interested in how we do that, I would encourage you to get in touch, because it might well be that we've got a way of doing that. But yeah, they'd be the two things that I'd say.
That's great. I think if I was in any way remotely interested in running or setting up a music venue, Craig, I would be on the phone to you straight away. How do we replicate this? What's the plan? For sure.
I would on that point, just very, very quickly, just point to two books that Music Venues Trust published. I can remember vividly being on holiday in 2019, sat on a sun lounger, reading How Do I Set Up a Live Music Venue? And How Do I Run a Live Music Venue? There are two books that the MVT have published that are free to download off their website.
Oh, great.
If you're interested in running a music venue, read them first.
Yeah. I was on the Music Venue Trust website yesterday, actually. Okay. And I was really impressed by the resources available on there and just the layout and stuff. So yeah, I think it's not just for live music venue kind of nerds. It's also for just, if you're interested in music and live music more broadly, I think it's an interesting resource. And I think they have a gig guide on there as well, so you can find what's on at venues near you. How did you find your audience in Birkenhead in the absence of a similar venue at first? Like, what did you do to find your crowd?
I think it's still something that we're working on, to be honest. I think, again, going back to that point around the almost strange competitive advantage of towns and smaller cities over large ones, is that if you're in a place like Birkenhead, which, you know, from a kind of cultural program point of view, there wasn't loads going on. I don't think that's a controversial thing for me to say. As soon as you actually take on a building, first thing that we did was, it's a three-story building. We painted in hot pink on the front of the building, "The future is Birkenhead," as a purely antagonistic kind of statement of intent. Mm-hmm. We, you know, use social media and traditional media and print campaigns to just get out to people and be like, this is happening in your town. I think as soon as you start doing that and kind of being noisy and being a little bit kind of playfully antagonistic, you find people and you draw people out. But it takes time. It takes time. And I do think that point around really good partnerships with the local council, with local housing associations, with local third sector, with the kind of organizations that people are engaging with in their day-to-day lives. You know, we've got strong relationships with like local youth services and the local Hive, which is massive kind of local youth provision in the middle of Bergen. I had those partnerships, and really investing in them long term becomes really, really important to get that cut through with local people. But, you know, a lot of it is kind of like talking to people, asking them what they want, following through on it, being trustworthy, being reliable,
yeah.
You know, having programs that you commit to and you're solid with and you're consistent with, so you can build trust.
Yeah.
People
are creatures of habit, right? And they want something that's reliable and consistent, and they know not necessarily that they're going to see the same thing there, but they can trust the curation, they can trust the program, they can trust the experience. And that's what they get with Future Yard.
Definitely. And I think also as well, I think it goes to a level beneath that as well, where it's, I think they can trust your motivations and your intentions.
Yeah.
You know, we were very, very open, and we always are. Like, we are a CIC. We're a non-profit. Like, you know, if we make a surplus, which is very much our intention, we want to make a surplus, that's reinvested in our programs. That's reinvested in what we do. You know, there's no shareholders. No one's taking a check if things go really well.
Yep.
It's like, we're here for local people and we invest in our programs. So you think your motivation and your intention, being really open and honest around that to build trust with local people, goes back to that point around, you know, we're not some kind of hipster commune, right? We're mm-hmm. local people that love this place and want it to thrive. We just know how to run music venue, and we want to use that as a way of bringing about positive change in people's lives.
And that brings us back perfectly to the theme at the outset about music being a vehicle for social change. And I think you've done a really great job of illustrating how that works in practice in a venue setting. But just to bring it back to the personal level, is there a band or a musician or a gig experience that changed your life?
Is there a... I can remember going to my first proper gig by myself, where Liverpool University. I mean, it wasn't that cool, unfortunately. It was a band called Reef, which we were a very 90s kind of like indie Britpop thing. But that sense, there was two things. It was that and that sense of kind of connection and excitement and kind of the physical nature of it. The power of a live music experience. It reminded me very much of going to football matches, like that visceral, communal, collective experience of being there with other people, and the power that that has. That got me as a 12-year-old kid in a room, just completely encapsulated by it. Whenever you think of Reef, and I don't think much now, but there you go. I think the other one as well, which is a little bit more, I remember I was lucky enough, I went to a comprehensive school just around the corner from where we are now. And when I was in year 9, I think, so I would have been around, 12, 13, our school actually had a composer in residence. It was a project that the local music service had done, where they had a composer in residence that went around the secondary schools. It was this American minimalist composer. And I did a project where we set a piece of Wilfred Owen poetry to music. Mm-hmm. And really, at a really kind of important point in my life, where I was playing guitars and playing in bands and kind of like discovering my idea of what music might be and could be, it gave me this kind of insight into a different kind of way that music can be used to tell stories.
Right.
And I think that even as a, you know, as a young boy at that point, I think that really made me realize that it wasn't as literal as maybe I thought it was. And it wasn't as kind of one dimensional as band play songs. It was like, you can use music in so many different ways to tell stories, to bring narratives to life, and to create emotional reactions in people. And I think my journey, and I suppose my career, and kind of where we are now with Future Yard, is very much about, it's about that. It's about using music as a way of kind of like opening up the art to the possible. And really, like, how do you do that and bring about that with people who just wouldn't have had that opportunity otherwise? You know, would I have had that opportunity if that 12-year-old version of me hadn't had that experience with that minimalist composer? Maybe I would.
I love how the contrast of those examples. You know, I think everyone has had a powerful experience with seeing a live band, but that project, you know, there's something really lovely and quite vivid about that. What a great note to end on. But actually, I have one more question. Are there any local musicians or bands that you'd like to plug that we can maybe check out on Spotify or any other listening platform?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I always love these ones. Let me give you two who've played at Future Yard loads and have been through our Propeller Artist Development Program and kind of, and maybe I'm just a big fan of. One is a post-punk band called Eyesore and the Jinx. So, yeah, Eyesore and the Jinx got their debut album, which is coming out later on this year, who I love. One of my personal favourites. I'd very much encourage you to go and check those out. And then the other one is an artist called Beija Flow. She's kind of like halfway between Bat for Lashes, Kate Moss, Cat Power, Kate Moss, Kate Bush.
Yeah, I was like, I don't remember Kate Moss having a music career.
No, Kate Moss. Did a brilliant... did you ever hear the version of Some Velvet Morning she did with Primal Scream?
No.
I'm trying to justify my Kate Moss slip. I wasn't talking about okay. Kate Bush, Cat Power, bit of Baffle Lashes. I love Beija Flow. She's amazing.
Like, how do you spell Beija?
B-E-J-A.
Okay, cool.
Beija Flow, F-L-O.
I'm going to look that up.
So yeah, they'd be my two.
Fantastic. Craig, thank you so much. It's been a really interesting conversation. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it as well.
There you go. That was Craig Pennington from Future Yard, making a pretty clear case for how music can change our communities and ultimately the world. I've just been checking out Craig's musical recommendations. So the song Waiting for the Sun by Beija Flow. I really enjoyed the video for that. It's a really surreal, darkly comic video and a really powerful orchestral cathartic piece of music and song. And then there was No More Nails, the track by Eyesore and the Jinx, which is I guess a more sort of indie punk type of sound. Really enjoyed that song as well. Their debut album Jitterbug is out later this year. So thanks again, Craig, for your recommendations as well as your time. We really enjoyed having you on. Thanks also to the Arts and Culture Finance team, my dear colleagues, without whom none of this would be possible. And finally, thank you, our listener, for listening to the whole thing and being here at the very end. Really grateful for your time. Stay tuned. There'll be a further episode soon. We're just trying to get these in the diary. Please, if you enjoy this, please like, subscribe, share with your friends and colleagues. We're really keen to have you back. Thanks.